Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Tomorrow, Election Day. You've probably already heard this notion, but it bears repeating. It's hard to believe that the last nationwide general election was just a year ago. Of course, last year's voting experience only paled in a good way with the previous presidential election in 2004. And still, folks across the nation have labored since then to find ways to improve the process, from registration to casting the ballot to redistricting. And in Ohio, Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner convened two election summits, one in December and another in March, to deal with those issues. A bill that embraces the findings of those summits was introduced in August. And here to talk about the measure, what might work in Ohio and other elections issues, including redistricting, is Ohio State University political science professor emeritus Herb Asher. Welcome, Herb.
Good to be here.
And also League of Women Voters of Ohio election specialist Peg Rosenfield. Peg, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
We were just talking a few minutes ago about how we'll never get to everything in less than an hour, which is about what we have, but we will do our level best. And I wanted to start out with just generally that general topic that sort of overshadows or the umbrella topic of everything, which is voter confidence. If you don't have it, you want it. And if you have it, maybe you squander it. I don't know. Herb, how are we doing on that score?
Well, I think we're doing better now than we were a few years ago, but keep in mind that the whole issue of election administration, election supervision, election mechanisms really had fallen off the radar screen for a lot of Americans. The League has always been interested in it, been concerned about it, but it probably took the presidential election in 2000 in Florida and the presidential election in Ohio in 2004 to remind citizens that how we run the elections, who runs the elections, the mechanisms, the rules, the procedures, the rulings, the interpretations are all very consequential. So really in the last 10 years, we have been reminded of the importance of this whole set of factors, and we've seen the federal government step in. We've seen the League of Women Voters renew its efforts. So we're seeing that election reform, partly done to increase citizen confidence in the process, is really on the agenda.
Peg, do you think we've achieved the confidence we need?
Oh, I don't think we'll ever achieve all the confidence we need, but I think things have vastly improved. Election procedures, rules, are really a classic example of the old saying about it, the devil is in the details. And a lot of these silly little details turn out not to be silly. It's very important exactly how everything is done. It's become increasingly difficult to explain things so that not only the voters understand it, but the poll workers understand it. And in some cases, even the boards of elections aren't sure what the rules are. So one of the things the League's been concerned about is that the rules are the same everywhere. So that if you're in Franklin County or Morgan County, you still are being treated the same way at the polls.
Well, or if you're in one precinct in Franklin County versus another.
Yeah.
It can vary that much.
That's right.
And it did in 2004. Mm-hmm. What happened? I mean, how many people were turned away that night?
We'll never know exactly how many, because it wasn't that they're turned away, because you can keep the polls open, but they had to leave and go home for their kids or go to work or whatever. And we really never have a count of that. But the suspicion is that it may have been thousands.
You agree, Herb?
Yeah.
It's like that. Folks had to leave. What's changed since 2004 now to safeguard more of those rights?
Well, we've done more analysis of how you better allocate voting machines. We've increased the number of voting. We've done more training. So I think people were very sensitive to the issue of long lines here in Franklin County. And I know the Franklin County Board of Elections actually commissioned some people to do some studies about how do you, in fact, improve that kind of situation.
What about the economics of voting now? There's some proposals out there around the country to condense voting days to just the primary and the general election in November because they're so expensive, particularly in this economic downturn. Counties just can't afford to pull it off.
That's one of the many proposals in the election enhancement bill that you spoke about that's been introduced. And they've had, I think, six hearings on it with We've testified and election board people they've had, I don't know, maybe a dozen people testifying. And as I understand, later this week, they're introducing a substitute bill that will incorporate, we think, some of the suggestions that have been made. And one of the things in that bill is that we would do away with February and August special elections, or maybe do away with one of them and just have those elections for, it's like school levies,
right,
and bond issues and stuff, to would only be with primary and general elections. But there are pros and cons on this, as with everything.
You know, in general, Americans have, and Ohioans have, many more opportunities to vote than citizens in most nations throughout the world. So even though we're used to doing it this way and having special elections at least twice a year and primaries and general elections, that really is atypical when you look at democracies throughout the world. So some people are talking about reducing the number of times that we can vote. But as Peg was indicating, some people will react to that and say, wait a second, you're taking away some opportunities. Now, you're not really taking away the opportunity to vote on the issue. What you're really taking away is what election you'll have the opportunity to vote on the issue. And as you said before, Ann, I mean, these special elections can be very, very expensive, particularly for smaller jurisdictions.
Exactly, and particularly when there's only one or two issues on the ballot, you still have to print up the ballot. It costs basically the same amount of money.
Keep the polls open, have the poll workers there, and the Southwestern School District in Columbus back in our special election back in August. Yeah.
Right.
But one of the other proposals and what some other states do is they run those elections strictly by mail, where they send a ballot to every registered voter in that school district or whatever, and then they don't have to open the polls.
In Ohio?
No.
No, other states,
no, other
right.
States.
Sorry,
yeah.
I missed that. Also, having the special elections in February and August, what's the argument about how that might dilute interest in voting? When you can, you know, people only show up, they know there's all these different theories and conspiracy theories that they have these special elections because they know only people who oppose it or only people who are for it will show up to the polls, and otherwise they don't care.
Yeah. Well, you typically know that in a special election, the turnout will be low. And so, as you said, the people who will turn out will be the people most passionately in favor or against. Sometimes there are reasons to have a special election, especially if there's a certain timing about when tax revenues would in fact start coming in. And I think sometimes local jurisdictions would make the argument that there are substantive and policy reasons to have a special election. But I think you're right. Many times people think a special election was chosen because you think you have a better chance of winning in a special election than in a regular election.
The policy issues being, particularly with the school districts like Southwestern, is they only have so much money. It's going to run out in January if they don't have another election. They had to do the one in August just to make sure that if they didn't have to do it in November again, they would be better off. Okay. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 if you would like to join the conversation. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Did you have any problems with voting last year? If you did, let us know. 614-292-8513. So in 2005, Herb, you led a group, Reform Ohio Now, and they put four issues on the ballot. What happened?
They got clobbered.
Yeah. I mean, people say they want change and they're frustrated and there's the confidence issue, but
– Well, I think there's a couple
of
things.
They got clobbered.
They didn't just lose. They got clobbered.
Right.
And I think there are a couple of things here. One, there were too many issues. If I had my druthers, it would have been one issue. It would have been redistricting because that's the one I'm really passionate about. But we had four issues. The issues themselves were complicated. So I think that really makes it very, very difficult to make the case. And then when you look at the patterns of support in terms of organized groups and political parties, for example, the State Democratic Party remained neutral on the issues. 10 Democratic county chairs, including Cuyahoga County, came out against them. The Ohio Republican Party came out against them. A number of the newspapers came out against all or some of the issues or whatever. So I think we really had a situation where, in fact, we didn't really have an effective coalition that was bipartisan. In fact, and if anything, it were the political parties either were neutral or against us on it. But again, I think we tried to do too much, and our issues were very complicated.
It seems to me folks who worry about what the political parties are doing and that they wield too much power might have voted if that was what was moving them. But usually the people that listen to the parties are the people who are members of the party. They don't pay much attention, do they?
Well, again, it was an odd year election with a fairly low turnout. And the people who turn out tend to be the party regulars who do pay attention to what their parties recommend.
One more thing before we move on, as far what I think of as the busy ballot syndrome. People are getting, you know, they're getting into the booth, and there is so much. Well, there were, one of the problems in 2004, I guess, was just having to read the ballot was very time consuming, and that's something that's been improved upon since then. But not just the length of the issues, but the number of issues has increased dramatically since I moved here 20 years ago.
Sure, and yet in comparison to other states, particularly in the West,
right.
You know, if we have 3, 4, or 5 in any particular year issues, you know, California could have a dozen. And so imagine the burden on voters in those states. But that does raise the question, too, of what can we do better in terms of informing people about ballot issues? As you know, we do require that these ballot issues, the pros and cons, the actual language, be published multiple times in the major newspapers throughout the state. But that's not very helpful to voters. And some states actually have the Secretary of State's office proactively send out a written description to every registered voter or every household with a registered voter in it, a brief summary of the issues or whatever. You can find the information here in Ohio. You can go online. You can look at the league's information bulletins. You can read the newspaper summary and actual wording of the amendments. That's very time-consuming for voters. So if we're going more and more to this kind of decision-making, which we call direct democracy, it might be good to think about what other mechanisms could we do to help inform citizens about that.
Yeah, Pat.
All three of the West Coast states send out these information on ballots on both the issues and the candidates. And Ohio, years ago, used to send a notice to every registered voter of state issues, but they changed it to the publication only as a money-saving thing. And I'm sure it does save money, but I think it really does keep voters from knowing as much as they probably need to know about issues.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. Then we will return to our conversation with Ohio State University political science professor emeritus Herbert Asher and also League of Women Voters of Ohio election specialist Peg Rosenfield. If you have an election question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
President Richard Nixon labeled illegal drugs public enemy number one and declared war. In October, President Obama changed the federal government's unrelenting stance to let state laws cover medical marijuana. So what's next? I'm Neil Conan. Drug czars and cops on the next phase in the debate on drugs, plus the opinion page. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins at 2 o'clock this afternoon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. Currently 46 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1020. Looking at the weather forecast for today, sunshine this morning, a few clouds move in this afternoon, and a high right around 60 degrees. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low of 40. And for Election Day tomorrow, some sunshine and a little chilly with a high of only 48. The low Tuesday night, right around freezing, a low of 33 degrees. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm speaking with Herb Asher. He's the Ohio State University political science professor emeritus. And also Peg Rosenfield. She is with the League of Women Voters of Ohio. She's their election specialist. They are here to talk about election reform issues. Peg, can you tell me about the League's lawsuit in 2005? There was the settlement agreement occurred this year.
How much do you want to know?
Well, just a
it
thumbnail.
Was it was a four-year.
It's been around a while.
It was a four-year process.
Give us about a minute of it.
Okay, let me. There were four things that we were specifically looking for: uniformity and consistency around of procedures,
precinct to precinct, county to county. Yep.
Exactly. Promoting pre-election planning, so that we would everybody would be prepared for as much as possible, and then you would know what went wrong, what went right, so you do better planning the next time. Increasing the recruitment and training of poll workers and election officials, which is already taking place to a great extent, and instituting consistent data collection and monitoring of key aspects of the election administration.
Such this, as?
The accountability of all the things. If you do the planning and there are all these different aspects that you need to plan for, then you go back and collect the what worked,
okay. What
didn't work, how you need to improve it. So those are the four main things that we were looking for.
And then the settlement agreement this year?
Provided that those things need to take place.
Okay.
And that we can monitor them for the next 5 years. The idea being that if they are followed through for 5 years, they become institutionalized, and then we're no longer involved, and the system will take care of itself. We hope
until we have another 2000.
The point is, we do not sue all the time. We're not a litigious organization, but that we really felt that Ohio's election system had become dysfunctional.
But a lot of the stuff that was called for in the settlement or in the lawsuit were issues that the league had been working on for a long time.
Yes, and that's why we sued. We didn't feel we were getting the results we needed.
And that's why – is that why the Secretary of State had those summits then, was in response to that, or was it in addition to that?
Oh, I think it was in addition. I don't really know for sure whether it was partially in response, but I think she recognized that there were things that needed to be fixed. Mm-hmm. And so the summits really brought everybody in to discuss it who was interested, including some out-of-state experts – and all kinds of people who were interested in elections in Ohio to come up. And they came up really with a surprising number of things where everybody pretty much agreed.
What does everyone agree on?
Well, that we have to do something about too many provisional ballots, for one thing, and that people are being disenfranchised who've done everything right, and for some reason their ballots don't get counted. We have to fix that.
Do we know how many ballots weren't counted the last time?
Oh, I've seen the numbers, but I can't remember what they are.
Yeah.
I think Ohio has had a decent election administration system. Everything's relative. The issue of consistency, we were ahead of certain states. Of course, Florida's probably a very bad example here. But we had, when we used punch card voting, we had already had a standard, which we then actually put into law, about whether or not hanging chads would count. And it had to have two corners punched, and they would count. It was a very simple standard. If you remember in Florida, as they were doing the recount in 2000, they were making up the rules on a county-by-county basis, and they started all of a sudden talking about pregnant chads, dimple chads, and all of that.
Yeah.
And that probably is one of the best examples of what Peg is talking about, is that where you have inconsistency, you're not actually treating voters fairly, and you then raise questions about actually the integrity of the election system, because why is this county coming up with this rule or this procedure and another county come up with a different one? So I think Ohio has been better than some other states, but I think what Peg's talking about are really improvements on a system that was working reasonably well. But, you know, the issue about election reform and election administration is, you know, if elections are decided by huge margins, then nobody really notices that there could be a 1% error or
2%. Who cares, right?
Yeah. But when you then have a string of close elections, and of course, again, Florida in 2000, Ohio in 2000, and they're highly visible elections,
right,
or you have a Senate race in Minnesota, as we had last year, that went on for months and months after the election, then it reminds people that the more you can establish justified and consistent standards and procedures, the better you protect the system, the better you serve the voters, and the more likely you are to generate confidence in the outcome.
If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We do have an email. It's from Don. Don wrote, "There are several constitutional amendments on the current ballot. Some I agree with and some I don't. However, I plan to vote against all of them because I believe that they are legal issues, not necessarily constitutional ones. If your guests could explain to me why they are proposed amendments rather than new laws, I might reconsider." Well, of course, they won't be trying to influence you one way or the other, but what is the distinction, Peg or Herb, about between why something ends up being a proposed constitutional amendment versus something that could be handled legislatively?
Well, Peg. Number one has to be in the Constitution if it's to take place, because we have a limit on how much the state can be indebted, and this is adding to the debt, and the only way you can do that is with a constitutional amendment.
Okay, and issue one is the one that would generate revenues through the sale of bonds to give bonuses to returning veterans and veterans who have returned from everything from Desert Storm up to our current wars.
Yes. And the legislature cannot do that.
Now, the League has tried to get that limit on indebtedness extended. Is that right?
Yes.
Is that still something that's of interest?
Years, like, in the 1920s or 1970s.
Yes, 1970s.
We tried to get the constitutional debt limit tied to some kind of measure of the League's the state's revenue.
Right.
Yeah. Instead, the limit is $750,000.
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah, which is
But that's effectively our balanced budget amendment. That really means here is anytime you want to incur debt, anytime the state wants to, you have to go to the voters to have a constitutional amendment approved that would allow you to incur debt. The issue number one, I thought another way of looking at it is, why did they choose the constitutional amendment route to generate the revenue for this? One could also say, why not just simply pay for it out of annual operating funds, general revenue funds? And part of the answer then is simply the stress on the state budget.
Right.
So they decided to, in fact, go the route of selling bonds, but that's incurring debt. And therefore, as Peg said, you have to go to the constitutional amendment process to incur additional debt.
Okay. So there's a logical explanation perhaps for that. That's just a fundamental rule. Yeah. But the others could have been dealt with legislatively, for instance, the casino issue or the
the casino,
just blanked out on issue two.
The casino issue, I mean, again, I think people can argue about this, but if you really believe that there is a prohibition in the Ohio Constitution for the expansion of gambling, that the only thing that really is allowed is the lottery and casinos and, who knows, maybe slots at racetracks or whatever. But some people would argue that that you would have to go the constitutional amendment route. And then the question becomes, there really are two paths there. One is the legislature, by a 3/5 vote, could put something on the ballot, or interest individuals could, in fact, go through the petition, the signature collecting drive, and put something on the ballot. And what's interesting about issue three that's on the ballot tomorrow is that, I don't know whether it's going to pass or not, but if it does pass, I assume there'll be many people in state government who'll be saying to themselves, oh my goodness, we should have put something on the ballot, let the voters approve it, and what we would have put on the ballot would have provided a much better deal for the state of Ohio in terms of revenues generated and things like that. But I think probably issue three probably does need to, again, there'll be people arguing about this, probably needs to go the constitutional route. Issue two on the livestock.
Livestock.
That could go, that could have gone either way. But I think what you had here was the interests in support of issue two. The agriculture interests in the state of Ohio went to the legislature and the governor and said, we want to go the constitutional amendment route. And the reason we want that is that provides greater protection. If you simply went the statutory route and had the legislature approve a law, why, the next legislature could repeal that law or whatever. in order to repeal a constitutional amendment, you will have to then have another constitutional amendment on the ballot to do that. So I think they believe they're getting greater protection by going the constitutional amendment route.
Well, they also have said in different forums that I've listened to and attended that they wanted the legislature to vote on it, and that's what they asked for originally, but the legislature couldn't get it passed through the legislature as was. But however, to get it put on the ballot, it's easier. Everyone can say, well, yeah, I believe in the voter's right to choose, so I'll support putting it on the ballot. Getting back to issue three, though, wouldn't the expansion to slots at the racetracks have been an expansion of gambling, or that was going to be litigated?
That
probably
was going to be litigated.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Give us a call. Weigh in on the number of elections. Callers, listeners, should we have voting in May and August in the off years or not? What do you think? And give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Bill, you're on the air. You have a question for Herb?
Yes. Good morning, Herb.
Good morning.
Two questions. One is, I get from your comments in the last 2 minutes here that you believe, I think you believe, that the issue three ballot issue should be on the should be on the election because gambling is not allowed in Ohio.
The expansion.
Yeah,
right?
I'm not a lawyer, but I would think here this is a sufficient expansion that, you know, it's not Keno. I think it's sufficiently new, different. You know, huge and all of that, that probably it should be a constitutional amendment before the voters.
Okay, and as the moderator said, our goal here is not to influence people one way or the other, but I was curious about your comment that said that the General Assembly may look at this and say, oh, we should have gotten involved and got a better deal. That is one of the opponents' arguments. That comment tends to slant people to vote no. I don't think that's what you want to do.
No, but I think, I understand that, but I think here it simply will be a fact of life that we could – there are two ways this could have gotten on the ballot. We've actually had what? We've had the racetrack owners. We've had the Wilmington interest. You know, we've had now Dan Gilbert.
Four other times.
Yeah. So we've had gambling interests fighting gambling interests to put, you know, to put something on the ballot. And what's interesting about these issues is oftentimes it winds up one set of gambling interests, in fact, opposing another set of gambling interests. So the only point I'm making here is that, you know, is that if this passes, it, you know, I think some people will make the argument, and whether it helps the one side or the other, people will make the argument. We missed an opportunity. And that may be another way of saying that if it is defeated, maybe at some point the governor and the legislature should say, look, one of these days, one of these issues might pass, and maybe we the elected officials should in fact come up with a plan that does the best possible job for the state of Ohio and let the voters make a decision on that.
But that implies that that issue three is not the best possible.
No, it doesn't. There's a chance that it might not pass. I mean, that's just logistical.
Yeah.
That's just statistical. I mean, there's a chance. So if it doesn't
–
If it doesn't pass, then it might make other entities reconsider the value of putting it on the ballot and trying themselves.
You know, one way to get the legislature's and the governor's attention is if, in fact, issue three were to lose by a 51-49 margin, hypothetically. I mean, yeah. Then maybe they'd say, well, maybe we better not – maybe we shouldn't leave it to the gambling interests to define the content of the proposal. Maybe we and the elected officials should, in fact, try to do this. But, again, let's wait till tomorrow and see what happens.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Rod, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I was wondering, it seems to me like there's a lot of special interest legislation and other types of legislation that is being dumped into the Constitution that, I wonder if the Constitution is an appropriate place for this, or if this, maybe we ought to change the Constitution so that people can legislate instead of having to change the Constitution every time they vote on an issue.
Well, one of the problems is that it's really easier to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot than it is to try and change things in the statutes, because while you have to have more signatures, you do it all at one time. Whereas if you want to change the statutory law, you have to get some signatures, wait for the legislature to act or not act, and then go back a second time and get more signatures. And that two-part process is very hard to do, to gin up the enthusiasm twice instead of once. So I think a lot of people go to constitutional amendment as the easier way to accomplish what they want.
But I think the caller is also saying that somehow, and the League has always said this, that constitutions should be reserved for matters of overriding principle and governance, and that, in fact, one should not be putting in the specific kinds of things that benefit one interest or another. Now, that's a very lofty, idealistic notion of, you know, of a constitution, but it turns out that interest groups who want to pursue their own agenda, as Peg said, oftentimes find it easier to go the constitutional amendment route, or they'll circumvent the legislature because the legislature won't go along with them or whatever. But whatever the case, we are seeing things that are being put into the Constitution that I think the League of Women Voters would say are not appropriate to a constitution. And I think in the past the League has oftentimes opposed things that while they might think the idea is good, the location is wrong. It shouldn't be in the Constitution. It should be in statutory law.
Well, my favorite example is that we have defined soda pop as food in our Constitution. This does not strike me as a constitutional issue.
Because it could change. These kind of definitions are – and it's much less likely that even though everyone might agree that it's changed, that you would then have to go back. The only way to null and void a constitutional amendment is to vote it out again.
And it's not exactly a Bill of Rights issue. It's not exactly a structure of government, separation of powers. I mean, I think sometimes the League, you know, makes, again, this very – and I'm not – you know, I'm speaking on behalf of the League at my own peril here. But
on the record.
But the League really does look at the Constitution as a document that should be reserved for broader principles of democratic governance.
Okay. Rod, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Justin, you're talking about the number of elections we have every year. You're on the air.
Absolutely. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
It seems to me that if it was very important for the legislators to the rights of people to vote was important, it would make voting a national holiday, make it easier for people to actually go out and vote. I mean, the turnout in our country is a lot less than in other countries, and I think people are really busy, and maybe why. I just wanted to know, especially I really appreciate the League of Women Voters, and I wanted to just get your thoughts on that.
Okay, Peg, that means you get to go first.
Well,
thanks, Justin.
I believe there is a proposal in Congress about changing, making a national holiday so much as changing when we do it, no longer doing them on federal elections on Tuesday. But there's thought of having them on Saturday or Sunday or something. But there are really strong arguments on any change you do. There are a lot of people who think it should be a national holiday, maybe move it to Veterans Day or something. But there are if you have a holiday, is everybody simply going to go off and go shopping instead of voting? I mean, I don't have an answer to this, but I think that what the caller is proposing is becoming discussed more and more widely, that we need to do something.
You know, I nowadays with the day after Thanksgiving, we got to take a break real quick. But I would nowadays think that the would everyone just go shopping argument would be more valid because of what we know about consumerism in our country. But the idea of not having it at a national holiday started a long, long time ago. You know, to make it a voting day and a regular work day was long before we became obsessed with buying things and taking time off and going on vacations instead of staying home and voting.
But the historical reasons for Tuesday I don't think are terribly valid anymore. You couldn't travel on Sunday, so you had all day Monday to travel to the county seat in mud roads and vote on Tuesday. Well, okay. I don't think that's true anymore much.
Okay. We got to take a break right now. In the meantime, if you've got a comment or a question about voting reforms, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to get to redistricting when we get back with Herb Asher. We're talking with Herb Asher. He is the Ohio State University political science professor emeritus, and also Peg Rosenfield. She is the election specialist for the League of Women Voters of Ohio. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I listen to WOSU because it's one stop for international and local news. The news about where my friends live, where I live, and what's going on around me. It's a place to find that information in an intelligent manner, not have to worry about commercial bias. My name is Jeff Johnson, and WOSU is my source for news and information as it relates to my friends and family around the world, as well as here in Columbus, Ohio.
And good morning. You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. 48 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1040. And stay right here in just about 20 minutes for Hour 2 of All Sides with Ann Fisher. We'll hear about Issue Number 4, the proposed property tax levy for Franklin County Children's Services, and a discussion of issues related to foster care and child abuse in Central Ohio. That discussion begins in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Ohio Wesleyan University's Sagan National Colloquium, presenting author and NPR commentator Andre Kadrescu Tuesday evening, November 3rd. The lecture is open to the public. More information is online at owu.edu.
In the weather forecast for today, sunshine this morning, a few clouds this afternoon, and a high near 60 degrees. Cloudy tonight with a low of 40. For Election Day, some sunshine and a high of only 48. The low Tuesday night, 33 degrees. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm speaking today with Ohio State University political science professor emeritus Herb Asher and also League of Women Voters of Ohio election specialist Peg Rosenfield. We're talking about potential election reform in the state of Ohio, maybe even nationally. If you have a comment or question, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let me know what you think about having election days on just 2 days a year instead of also having special elections. Herb, before we run out of time, I agree. I want to talk about redistricting. This is something I've been covering as a State House reporter and down the lines for 20 years now. What's going on with that, and what is the possibility that we really will ever get
Well, the issue is still alive, and the credit goes to Peg and Joan Lawrence and some academics and all of that. Credit also goes to Senator John Husted, who, while he opposed our amendment in 2005, made a pledge that he would work to keep the issue of redistricting alive, and he actually has a bill that passed the Senate, is now over in the House. The Ohio House is considering putting together its own piece of legislation. And when you talk about redistricting, there's really sort of, I think, two general issues here. One is the composition of the board that will adopt a plan, but also then the other issue is the criteria that should be used in evaluating plans. But I think for many of us, the issue of redistricting is how do you, in fact, create a set of legislative districts that have a greater level of competition in a greater number of districts. The process we have right now, doesn't matter which party controls the process, what you do if you're in control of the process is you create a smaller number of districts that the minority party wins overwhelmingly, and then a larger number of districts that your own party wins quite comfortably. But there aren't very many competitive districts.
Well, and on the other side of the coin from that is the districts are composed in such a way that one end of the district has very little to do with the other end of the district. So when it comes to what the voters need and what the voters want, there's been that argument made as well.
Yeah, that sometimes happens. But the real challenge here is if you have districts that are heavily Democratic and heavily Republican and you design them that way, then, in fact, the general election is not really the key race. It's the primary. And typically, in a if you want to win a Democratic primary, you move to the left because that's the Democratic voters are tend to be more liberal. You want to win a Republican primary, you appeal to the more conservative base. And then the general election, basically that whoever wins the Republican Party, you know, wins the Republican nomination, wins the election. You get a bunch of people who are probably fairly conservative on the Republican side, fairly liberal on the Democratic side. And while that's going to happen under any system, if you could have a larger number of legislators who come from more balanced districts, more competitive districts, that might suggest there's a greater opportunity to reach across the aisle, to have the kinds of discussions that should occur in a legislature, looking at the merits of issues from both sides. But that's not the way it works right now. So there are many of us who believe that redistricting, if done appropriately, could really lead to some policy consequences in the legislature and perhaps also change the tone of some of the things that are going on in the legislature.
So why now might there be change versus 20 years ago?
Oh, I think one the league takes full credit for much of this.
That duly noted.
We've been working for Joan Lawrence, our former state president, former state rep, has been working on this since the 1970s. But most recently, in the last 2 years, we started working on it. And one of Herb's colleagues, Richard Gunther, has helped us see some new aspects to look at. You don't just look at compact districts and holding counties and cities together. But in addition to competitiveness, we also look at what they call representational fairness, that if we have we're a fairly evenly divided state, and so at one point our congressional district was two-thirds one party and one-third the other. That doesn't represent Ohio. But the big thing that came out of not these four things, but also they're all measurable. You can actually grade them like you would a test.
Which are?
These compactness, communities of interest, competitiveness, and representational fairness. Yeah. And these can all be graded and scored mathematically. And then what we're proposing is you simply – you ask – anybody can turn in a plan based on these. And we ran a little competition to show how it would work in the congressional seat. And it works. It really does work. And you come out – with reasonable looking maps, and you can then go and then rank all these plans, and you come out with some winners, and then we would say, okay, you take the top five or whatever, and you can use any one of them.
Yeah. What would the vested interest be in the parties of supporting something like this, though?
Well, state legislative redistricting is currently done by a 5-person reapportionment board. That board has a legislative Democrat and a legislative Republican, so they cancel each other out. The other three members are the governor, the auditor, and the secretary of state. So whichever political party wins two of those three winds up effectively controlling the reapportionment board for the purposes of state legislative redistricting. One of the reasons why, in fact, people might have some interest in this now is the next time we're going to vote will be 2010. Tell me today which party is going to control the redistricting, the reapportionment board next year. We know that the Democrats, you know, if Bruner were running for reelection or if the Democrats could hold on to the Secretary of State's race and the governor was reelected, they would have control of the reapportionment board. But Bruner's not running. And in fact, probably a lot of people would say that Senator Husted is the favorite for Secretary of State. Who's going to win the auditor's race? Mary Taylor may be the favorite, but David Pepper could run a very strong race and be a very well-funded candidate. And it looks like the governor's race is going to be very competitive. At a time where neither party can be assured that it's going to control the reapportionment board, maybe that's a good time now to in fact say, hey, let's change it. Let's improve it. Let's do the reform now, when nobody for sure can calculate their own immediate political self-interest.
And it's been a long time since that's been the case.
Well, yeah. I mean, and the fact that where we are right now with a bill already having been approved in the Senate, the House actively considering something, and the timing, if the legislature could come to an agreement, could put something on the ballot in May So it would have to go to the voters to change the system. The timing is perfect. But will it happen? I don't know. But I think probably given the work that so many people have done in the league and in reform groups and academics and all of that, and given that there are people in the legislature who in fact are talking about this right now, who knows? Maybe we could actually see something happen. And again, ultimately, though, the voters will get to decide.
Peg Rosenfield, what do you think?
I have more hope this time. The league, this is the third time we've tried this. It actually went to the ballot in 1981.
One, yes.
And was defeated because exactly what you're saying, one of the parties opposed it. And it must have at least acquiescence from both parties, or it doesn't chance. Either party can kill it. But this year, I think we may have a chance. And for exactly the reasons Herb's saying, and on top of which, it's a totally new, different process than anybody that I know of has ever tried before. And it really is fair. And if you aren't sure you're going to control it, maybe your second choice is to have a fair system.
Interesting.
aren't we naive?
If you'd like to join us in our talk about election reform, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ahmed, you'd have some questions about who can vote and how.
Yes.
You're on the air.
I'm a Somali immigrant. I'm a citizen. I fought for the general election. The many Somalians, 40,000 Somalians live in this country today, have the most green card. They have a resident. They can vote for the local election. That's what my question is.
Okay, so you're asking if folks who just have green cards can vote in the elections?
Local elections, not
any elections. Okay, okay. Well, Peg, you're shaking your head, so
no.
Tell us. What
not in Ohio. In Ohio, you must be a citizen. There is the only place I know where people with a green card can vote on local elections is in one county in Maryland, in the state of Maryland. But I've never heard of any place else where you can do it.
And is there much talk? I have heard talk, but there's no talk
no.
in Ohio about changing that
no.
at all.
No,
right.
Not at all.
Let's move on to the issue of a statewide elections board and making it nonpartisan or bipartisan or some such thing, or taking away the power of the Secretary of, which is yet another place where the Secretary of State wields quite a bit of power when there is a disagreement. They kind of have they're the tiebreaker. Peg, what's the history of this? What are the virtues and the pros and cons of
This is one of the issues that's been discussed in the election enhancement bill,
right.
House Bill 260, change when some of the instances where the board can't agree, particularly in deciding how many early absentee in-person voting sites they can have if they don't agree that the secretary would break the tie. And there's been, shall we say, an enormous amount of discussion on this. And there are lots of arguments, pro and con, that you need a tiebreaker because boards of elections, by definition, are an even number, two Democrats, two Republicans. And they do sometimes split along party lines. But the boards do not want the secretary making that decision. I am very anxious to see when the substitute bill is introduced this Thursday how they have addressed this issue, because it's one of a number of things that there is not unanimity of opinion on how this should be done.
The way the legislation's written now, the current form, would be a bipartisan? Or how is it written now?
Well, I think as the bill's written now, if the board disagrees on how many and where sites should be, if they don't have a majority of three, it would go to the Secretary of State to decide it.
Okay, bipartisan, nonpartisan election board, taking away that tie-breaking power from the Secretary of State.
Only on that specific issue. And there may be some other specifics, but it isn't generally taking it away.
Okay. Yeah.
But the fact is that I think Secretary of State Bruner, I think Senator Husted, who's running for Secretary of State, both of them have raised the issue, what is the appropriate role for the Secretary of State in election administration? So just getting that issue out there, because, again, it is the case. We know we have a tradition in Ohio, and it's not just the Secretary of State. It oftentimes involves our courts or whatever, that you can oftentimes predict how a judge or how the Secretary of State will vote on a particular elections issue. And typically, not always, and in fact, it's probably better today than it was in the past, but typically they're going to vote to support their party's position.
And they may have all kinds of rational reasons for doing that.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, there probably in many cases are arguments on both sides, right. So why shouldn't I vote with my party? But I think at least now we've gotten the issue out there, do we really want to have a partisan elected official to be the tiebreaker and to be the person overseeing our elections? What's interesting is that redistricting, depending on what we do with redistricting, if one took the Secretary of State out of the redistricting process, because that's one of the five members of the reapportionment board, then I bet you our elections for Secretary of State would look a lot different. And that might help solve part of the problem, because now you wouldn't have the political parties so actively involved in the election of a Secretary of State if that person were not on the reapportionment board.
Well, and you bring one of the things the League recommended first, I believe, 5 years ago, was that we should, in fact, take the Secretary of State's office out of election administration and assign those responsibilities to a nonpartisan
Executive director.
The way we do the Ethics Commission and the Elections Commission and so forth, so that it is totally nonpartisan.
I don't have enough time to ask this question, but as usual, I'll squeeze one in. How do you find somebody on the face of the earth in Ohio who would get that kind of support to be a nonpartisan administrator who is truly nonpartisan?
So. You can do it. In the first place, you'd have the person appointed by a group or the governor or somebody, and have them probably approved by an overwhelming majority of the legislature. Okay. Elections Canada is run this way.
That's all I have time for. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher, my guest today, Ohio State University political science professor Emeritus Herb Asher and League of Women Voters of Ohio election specialist Peg Rosenfield. As we predicted, we ran out of time. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.